This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. United Auto Workers are on their fifth day on strike against the big three U.S. automakers Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, which includes Chrysler and other brands. So far, it's been a partial strike limited to manufacturing plants in Missouri, Michigan, and Ohio, representing roughly 13,000 of the 146,000 workers in the full union. Union President Sean Fain said this week that if the two sides don't make significant progress by Friday, the strike will expand to include more workers at more plants around the country. The UAW is seeking wage increases and expanded benefits that automakers say are beyond what's sustainable for their businesses. It's a historic strike against the three automakers. We're learning more now about the labor market and the economic forces involved, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of this strike? Do you know someone in the UAW? Are you involved in this or in the auto industry? Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Childers is professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. He's an expert on labor unions, collective bargaining, production standards, and labor management relations in union environments. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Always a pleasure, Rob.
Michael, set the stage for us a little here. How do we get to this point where the UAW is doing this sort of rolling strike?
It's been unique in this respect. Their tactics have completely deviated from previous playbooks. And I think it really does have the auto manufacturers on edge in that, yeah, they've basically broken all of the traditional rules in terms of how they've negotiated contracts in the past.
What specifically is the UAW seeking for workers?
Again, I think your intro covered it fairly well, and it's similar to a lot of the other labor negotiations that have occurred this summer. I'm thinking of specifically the UPS and Teamsters negotiation. But basically what workers are looking for are substantial increases to their wages. They'd like to get back to where they had been, basically, in terms of purchasing power. It's not even necessarily that they're the raises that they're looking for, I guess. I'll put it in a different context, would get them back to parity with the wages that folks were earning prior to some concessionary contracts that have been negotiated. Another major bargaining point is the use of the disparate pay for the same work, what sometimes are called tiers. And that, again, was a major issue in the IBT-UPS negotiation. And maybe you've seen pictures of the UAW president, but that's what he's talking about when you see his T-shirt that says end tiers. So
let's give a listen to UAW President Sean Fain talking about the impact of a widespread auto worker strike on automakers and the economy.
In the last 4 years, the price of cars went up 30%. CEO pay went up 40%. No one said a word. No one had any complaints about that. But now, God forbid, that workers actually ask for their fair share of equity in the fruits of the labor and the product they produce, and all of a sudden it's the end of the world. So, the talking heads, the pundits, the companies want to say that, you know, if we strike, it can wreck the economy. It's not that we're going to wreck the economy. We're gonna wreck their economy, the economy that only works for the billionaire class. It doesn't work for the working class.
I want to get into that last point, Michael. Sean Fain, UAW president there, he has widened this in some ways beyond this is about automakers and the UAW to wider critiques of the U.S. economy. What do you think of that part of their unusual playbook?
I think it's just to bring more awareness that, again, and we've lost most of our auto manufacturing here in our state. Mm-hmm. But it's the idea being that, you know, what workers are asking for, and I think the point he's trying to make is it's not unreasonable, and it's actually very much in line with what is happening generally in the economy. It's that, hey, if the price of a gallon of milk and a gallon of gas goes up, we should be able to cover those expenses with our wages. We're here, we're generating the value, the profit that this company enjoys, and we'd like to share equitably in those profits.
Automakers have argued they couldn't sustain compensation at those rates. Here's Ford CEO Jim Farley also talking to CNN here about his worries.
Sean's requests are very clear. He proposed a nearly $300,000 fully fringed wage for each of our factory workers to work 4 days a week. And if we had done that in our business when we've had a couple of really great years here, we would have gone bankrupt many years ago. $15 billion of losses, we'd have to close plants, most people would lose their jobs, we'd have no money to invest.
And this is what companies often say when faced with a strike and demands for higher wages. But is there something to that? Are the big three automakers sustainable with this higher level of compensation that UAW workers are asking for?
They absolutely are. And I think, again, part of collective bargaining in the United States that it seems opaque to people who've never had to participate in it is that both sides have to go in with offers that are far from where they would be willing to settle, but that's the nature of the way it's conducted here in the United States. So, for example, the Ford person was actually citing as if they were going to agree to the opening proposal that the UAW made, which, of course, UAW is not necessarily expected. They would be happy to accept that, but they're not expecting that that's where things would settle. And I think corporate profits speak for themselves, right? Thanks to the Securities and Exchange Commission, we actually have access to corporate finances, and the finances bear out. This was the case with the Teamsters and the UPS strike as well, or the UPS potential strike as well, that the profits are there. What the workers are asking for are not unreasonable. Absolutely, does it reduce profits? Sure. Are the companies not going to make as much money as they would have liked? Of course. But again, it's not that it's unaffordable. It's that how much would you like to afford? So,
talking to Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, looking at the UAW strike, a partial strike so far. We'll see what happens on Friday if a deal isn't met. Love to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Your questions about what's at stake, how these kind of negotiations might work, and if you are personally affected, definitely love to hear from you. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael, you've watched over the years a lot of strikes and a narrowly averted strikes like the UPS one you mentioned. What are you watching for to see how the two sides negotiate and if they're going to arrive at a middle ground that they agree on?
Well, like you said, I started with that this was sort of unprecedented in terms of the way that the UAW has bargained with the big three always in the past. I think you've already pointed out, the other shoe is in the air with respect to, the union has already telegraphed that they would like to move towards concluding an agreement by noon Friday. Otherwise, there will be an escalation. They've basically said that. What I've also been watching is, in the past, the Canadian auto workers also bargained as a part of the United Auto Workers. Now it's a separate union called Unifor. And they've conducted their negotiations sort of in the old school tradition, in that they're only bargaining with Ford right now, and had actually threatened a strike against Ford at midnight yesterday, or this morning rather. And at the 11, literally between 11 and midnight yesterday, got a substantial offer, is the way it's been reported in the media so far, and so far have suspended that strike for another 24 hours. So this time tomorrow, the Ford workers in Canada may also be on the picket line.
A critique of strike efforts like this is that, okay, maybe UAW workers win, but that ups the incentive for automakers to open plants in other countries, or maybe in states with more lax labor laws. Could unions be shooting themselves in the foot here?
I think in a real sense, that cow has left the barn, in the sense that if you look at where all domestic manufacturing has been located site-wise for the last literally 40 years, it has been the case, right, that it's been primarily in the Southeast or in the global South, whether it's Mexico or the offshoring of jobs even further. So in a real sense, I don't know that that's necessarily a threat. And I think that's another point that we had not really brought up, which is another one of the major demands is the UAW is looking for assurances that, with the new technology coming online and the new vehicles being primarily electric, that foregoes the need for an engine and a transmission in these vehicles, which means Those are plants that employ many workers, and the UAW would like to see those workers be allowed to transition to things like battery factories, which are going to be coming online, obviously, to support the new EV.
So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Raleigh is with us in Oak Creek. Raleigh, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about the states that have right-to-work laws. How does that affect the workers, the company, the negotiations? How does that all work out? Can these workers go to work during a strike?
Raleigh, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, many states, including Wisconsin, now have these what are called right-to-work laws, limiting the power of unions in a lot of ways. Does that affect this ongoing strike and these negotiations?
No, thanks for the call. It's a really good question because I think it's confusing to a lot of people. Mm. What right to work does is actually, it was implemented as a part of the Taft-Hartley Act post-World War II after the large strike wave here in the United States. And a lot of people called it the clipping of labor's wings in a sense, because what it did was workers who are in a unionized environment are still represented by their union. As a matter of fact, their union has a duty, a legal duty, to represent them fully. They're still subject to the terms of the contract. I think your question is more, can people cross picket lines? Yes, obviously there's a word for that. In the labor lingo, they would call those folks scabs. And in a sense, what they're saying is, those are our jobs and you're actually going in and doing my work while I'm in a dispute with my employer. Right to work doesn't really play into that directly, for example. I guess the thing about right to work is the way it weakens unions is, even though unions are obligated by law to represent, negotiate contracts, defend these workers, the workers have the option to not pay their union dues. So hopefully that clarifies that for you, Raleigh. But yes, workers can obviously can cross a picket line. Most don't, because the most important word in the vocabulary of especially unionized workers is solidarity.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Madison Labor Education Professor Michael Childers about the UAW strike going on now against the big three automakers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a member of a union or maybe even the UAW? What do you think of this strike and how they're handling it? And in general, do you have questions? Do you have thoughts on how you want to see this all come out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Michael Childers, labor education professor at UW-Madison. He's with us today looking at labor negotiations between the UAW and the big three automakers that led to the current strike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the auto workers' strike? What questions do you have about the negotiations between the UAW and automakers? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Andrew is with us in Milwaukee. Andrew, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Andrew?
So I wanted to bring up, when I was in Argentina, I studied abroad there from UW-Madison, and there was a big strike going on. The public teachers were renegotiating their contracts, and the bus drivers, the subway drivers, it seemed like there was a lot of strikes in solidarity and mass mobilization of workers. And I remember hearing that that was illegal or something like that in the United States, kind of those cross-the-board strikes.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, I seem to remember historically there being solidarity strikes from unions not directly involved in a negotiation. Is that something that does happen? As Andrew asks, is that something that can happen?
I think it, in the sense that if it can happen or not, workers can do what they want to do. Sometimes even regardless of what their union leaders are telling them they should do. But I think it's a great question in the sense that the reason, yes, that's absolutely a part of labor history here in the United States. General strikes is what they were mostly called. And you saw these happen like citywide, like San Francisco will go on strike. Minneapolis will go on strike. when they passed our U.S. labor law, which was back during the Depression in the 1930s, part of what this it was the Wagner Act at that point. It's now called the National Labor Relations Act. And what it tries to do is to get the parties to work out their differences without having to resort to work stoppages, to strikes. And the reason why in the United States, well, two reasons why you don't see more of these widespread strikes or sympathy strikes is, number one, most unions and their employers, when they negotiate a mutual agreeable contract, will put in no strike, no lockout clauses, which basically means that for the duration of this agreement, we agree that we will not go on strike. So that's one sort of detriment to, as far as like that there would be a sympathy strike or other workers joining workers that are on strike against their employer. The other thing would be partly the changes in the law we mentioned, what the Taft-Hartley Act did with respect to the creation of the so-called right to work, where union members could actually opt out of paying their dues. Another change was it made secondary strikes, in other words, the strike against not the direct employer, against the law, and actually the unions could be liable for damages for going out on strike against someone that is not the primary target. So both of those contribute to the reasons why you don't see that very often here in the United States.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. William joins us now in Lake Geneva. William, hi.
Hi. My daughter is an engineering manager for General Motors, and her husband happens to also work for General Motors in the UAW. And it's interesting because last year, they each made over $100,000. The difference being that my daughter, with a master's in engineering and material science, divided up, she works on average 65 to 70 hours a week, and divided up her salary, and she makes less than her husband with just a high school degree did in the UAW hourly. And it kills me because I hear on the news that the average UAW worker makes close to $50 an hour, has 5 weeks paid vacation, has 17 paid national holidays. I'm 60 years old. I don't have those benefits, not even close.
William, thanks for the call. Michael, Williams saying UAW workers already have it pretty good.
They absolutely do. And that's the fruits of many, many negotiations with their employer and the sacrifices that generations of auto workers made prior to even these current negotiations. I guess the difference between the two scenarios that were discussed is, I'm assuming that the gentleman's daughter does not have a union. And in the United States, if you want to be able to sit down as an equal with your employer and bargain around hours, wages, and your conditions of work, the way you get those rights are by joining with your coworkers and forming a union. And interestingly, there are professional unions. For example, I think he said she's an engineer. Mm-hmm. The Boeing engineers that work for Boeing Corporation that build the airplanes have formed and do negotiate with Boeing as a collective bargaining agent. They're unionized.
William, thanks a lot for calling in. Michael, what are you watching for next now in this UAW partial strike to see if we're going to get some progress here?
Well, like everyone, I've been following it with a lot of interest and pretty closely. Before they actually took the three individual plants, one from each of the automakers out, I was curious exactly what direction they were going to go and how. So I'll be very interested to see what happens if there isn't significant progress by Friday in terms of how they choose to escalate, if it'll be more assembly plants, because another option that they could have taken that I think some people had expected was they could, and this comes from actually the history of the auto workers, if you take out a key component in the supply chain, for example, brakes, right? You can't ship any products if you don't have the parts available to have brakes on the vehicle. So by just striking the one plant, the ripple effect over some amount of time would impact all of the assembly plants, for example. So, I mean, I'm watching that in terms of how they choose to escalate on Friday, if they need to. And I'm also watching what's going to happen in Canada, because again, while they don't have near the footprint that the UAW does in North America, if they do strike Ford, that's going to have a pretty dramatic and pretty quick impact on Ford's operations.
And Michael, moving beyond the auto industry now, in addition to the UAW, you've mentioned the UPS narrowly averted strike. We had the rail workers. We've got the ongoing strikes for actors and writers in the TV and movie industries. It seems like there's a lot going on in the union world these days. Are we at some kind of turning point in American labor history?
I mean, you got to let the historians write that, right? I think it's interesting because, you know, the Gallup poll, as far as public opinion around unions, has never been this high in my lifetime. And I mean, I think the part we just left out were the things like the Starbucks baristas. And there has been sort of this, I mean, I think coming out of COVID, maybe a renaissance in terms of workers expecting more from their work life. And again, as I just mentioned earlier, the way in the United States you get the right to have a voice at work as an equal with your employer is by joining with your coworkers and forming a union.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure. Take care.
That's Michael Childers, professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. He was with us today to talk about the historic UAW strike against Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, now on its fifth day, possibly expanding on Friday if a deal isn't reached. Well, we don't have those plants closing here in Wisconsin, but do you have a connection with somebody who is in the middle of this story, who is on strike or looking at it happening over the next week or so? Love to hear from you at ideas@wpr.org. Again, you can email ideas@wpr.org if you've got a personal connection to this story. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, take a look at Wisconsin's controversial voting maps as redistricting lawsuits head toward the state's Supreme Court and a proposed law in the state legislature aims to overhaul the whole process. Find out all the different pieces about what's going on and what's at stake, and you could join in with your thoughts. What do you want to see happen? Get started now. Email ideas@wpr.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. A couple of weeks back, we talked to a physical therapist about adapting our exercise and fitness as we age. We heard from a lot of you from your 60s on up who are still doing amazing amounts of great exercise, much more than I do. One mentioned kayaking, a lot of kayaking. Well, I got inspired by that. I was out for a long weekend for a couple days there, went on a little trip, and my wife and I did go out kayaking on a lake a few times. It was great, but my wife went out one extra time while I stayed in, and she got a bonus, a bird-watching bonus, where she saw two bald eagles, one golden eagle, red-tailed hawk, and a few sandhill cranes. I didn't miss out completely. I saw a heron, a couple cormorants on one of my outings. But staying on shore that one time, I did not get the big bird bonanza. It's another surprising benefit of exercise. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The 24-hour news cycle has become a controversial mainstay of American political life, but TV news hasn't always been this way. In the early days of cable television, there was a lot of optimism about how it could be a force for public participation and democracy. Here's CNN founder Ted Turner announcing the launch of the channel back in 1979.
This news service will be called the Cable News Network, and will program continually updated half-hour segments of national news, business news, sports, and features 24 hours a day. I know that we will succeed, and I pledge to you that we will not let the American public down.
The rise of CNN is just one part of a much bigger story about cable television and how it came to be a dominant force in American politics. Our next guest chronicles that history in her new book, which shows how cable TV in many ways failed to live up to its political promises and ultimately set the stage for the fracturing and polarization we see today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch news programming on cable TV, one network, lots of networks, or do you steer clear of it? Either way, why? Has TV been a big part of your own political identity? Has that changed over the years? Were you around for the early days of the rise of 24-hour cable news channels? How did your political viewing change at that point? Were you ever a big C-SPAN fan? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Catherine Kramer Brownell is an associate professor of history at Purdue University. Her newest book is called 24/7 Politics, Cable Television and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You trace the technology, the spread of cable TV, going back as far as the late 1940s, which I didn't know. I want to fast forward a little bit to that moment when CNN and around the same time-ish C-SPAN come around. Remind us what the TV news landscape looked like before those big cable networks came along.
Yeah, that's really a transformative moment for the cable industry. C-SPAN launches in 1979 and then CNN the following year. And before that, people got their news on television in, 22 minutes, maybe an hour in a documentary series, but it was very limited. And this was part of the problem. People across the political spectrum could agree that having so little time devoted to informing the public about public affairs meant that they weren't getting the information they needed, that viewpoints were inherently excluded, especially if they are on the far left or the far right of the political spectrum. And so it's this effort to change news coverage that really motivates a diverse range of people to see the possibilities of cable television and having a more expansive dial and having more programs that didn't have to just cater to those half hour or 1 hour time slots.
And now CNN, it's become such an institution, it's hard to think of it as a scrappy underdog, but it and some other parts of the cable content and cable industry really throwing a lot of elbows out there trying to break what they claimed was in effect a monopoly of the TV networks. Can you talk about how that played out in the early days?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, during the 1960s and especially into the 1970s, network broadcast television had a monopoly. It was regulated by the FCC to control and to dominate the television landscape. And initially, cable TV emerged as simply a way to extend the signals of broadcasting to areas that couldn't access them, but because of terrain or distance. And so it really replicated and expanded broadcasting fare. But as frustrations with broadcasting mounted, cable TV operators realized that there is a business opportunity in playing up the limitations of broadcasting and selling cable not as an extension of broadcasting, but as an alternative, as a competitor, which could give more voice to these demands for diversity of perspectives in television.
Yeah, there was a political workshop. You start off the book, actually, in 1984, discussing how broadcasting had failed democracy and how cable could save it. That was the argument from the cable industry. Were there wider hopes from people in the political world and beyond that, yes, this is going to boost our public participation? This is going to make democracy better because we have more sources of information.
I think there absolutely were hopes, and there were many people within the cable industry and activists, many grassroots activists outside of the industry that truly believed that decentralizing information would enhance democracy because it would get so many different viewpoints and different perspectives out there to shape conversations, to shape American culture, but to shape American politics as well. But ultimately, what happens is that this democratic promise really becomes a public relations tool by the cable operators who see that highlighting the problems of democracy and the potential, the democratic potential of cable is good for business. It's good for business because it allows them to craft some very effective relationships with elected officials. C-SPAN, for example, is a nonprofit, but the way that that Brian Lamb got people, cable operators, to buy into that concept was he understood that he told them that if you want elected officials to know what cable is and to work to invest or to expand its reach, you need to give them a stake in it, to bring cable to Capitol Hill. And that's exactly what C-SPAN ultimately does. And so there's this effort to shape regulatory policies and to really advance more favorable regulations by forging these relationships with the elected officials, but also just making money by selling, getting people to buy in, getting subscribers to buy in, that they can find community and civic participation, and perhaps more importantly, sports and entertainment on the cable dial. So it's a multi-pronged effort that's really about expanding the business of cable television.
Talking to Catherine Kramer Brownell about her new book, 24/7 Politics, Cable Television and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your memories at 800-642-1234. Catherine, you were just talking about how the cable industry was reaching out to politicians. You also cover a lot in the book how politicians started to realize that, hey, these things are changing the game. They're changing our PR, our outreach. What were some of the first shoots of that as people realized what they could do with cable?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So cable does open up TV to new voices. And overwhelmingly, it's those who are frustrated, who are not finding opportunities on network broadcasting programs, that they are turning to cable out of desperation. And so there are a variety of different experimental strategies. Ones deployed by some fringe people, especially you see this in the Republican Party in the 1980s, where figures like Newt Gingrich were a minority, kind of a fringe member of the minority party in Congress at this time. And he's using something like C-SPAN. He's manipulating the camera angle, manipulating coverage to get his ideas out there and to build a national following. He's not using cable to talk to his constituents back in Georgia. He's trying to create conflict on C-SPAN. Frequently and overwhelmingly, initially, this happens to an empty chamber where he's making these grand speeches, making viewers think that he's, you know, calling out opponents and they're scared to challenge him. But in fact, he's talking to an empty chamber. And I think it's an example of kind of the political manipulations and calculations over how to use cable TV are very much at play, with politicians thinking about how they can use it to their political advantage, not necessarily to inform constituents, but to really help them gain more political power.
Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I just try to be careful here with the use of language surrounding what we see nowadays. When we say something that's such and such news organization, news would imply something that's factual, perhaps trustworthy, fact-checked, and then more often than not, it is opinion and editorial, kind of pointed towards a specific audience than really an unbiased, you know, factual bias of what's going on.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And an interesting point, Catherine, the blurring that happens over time on cable between news and, as Chris says, opinion and editorial.
Chris is exactly right. And that blurring happens over, you know, really from the 1960s through the 1990s. You have a triumph of that blurring by the 1990s. And part of the reason that becomes blurred is because you have a shift in the idea of the public interest. Increasingly, the public interest, which used to be why upholding this public interest requirement used to be why network broadcast news programs existed as proof that they were serving, they had this civic role. That ultimately fades away as the media landscape becomes deregulated and the consumer interest becomes conflated with the public interest. And then it becomes all about what is going to sell, what's going to get ratings, what's going to generate attention rather than necessarily what is going to inform people about the world around them. There's this really interesting moment I chart in the book where you have Walter Cronkite raising concern about the consumer interest overwhelming the the public interest. And one cable operator, John Malone, says, no, the people will demand, the market will demand accuracy and factual information. But I think that we've seen that that's not necessarily what has happened.
Chris, thanks for the call. We're talking to Catherine Kramer Brownell from Purdue University, looking at her new book. It's called 24/7 Politics, Cable Television and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the 24-hour news cycle has been helpful or harmful when it comes to informing the public? Are there any cable channels or programs that you think have been a force for good in American politics at some point? Or do you think it's been mostly negative over the last few decades? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with historian Catherine Kramer Brownell about her new book, 24/7 Politics, Cable, Television, and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you there for the major moments in political history that aired on cable TV? Do you remember the switch when cable TV got big, especially in the news? Do you watch any of the big networks now? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Mark is with us in Green Bay. Mark, hi.
How's it going? I was wondering what she thought of how the elimination of the fairness doctrine by Reagan had an effect on this. And then also Fox just got sued by Dominion for $700 million. How will stuff like that keep things like Fox in check?
Mark, thanks for the call. Two big points there, Catherine. First of all, you do in the book talk a lot about the fairness doctrine and its passing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the fairness doctrine is part of that the embrace of deregulation, the reliance on the marketplace to deliver for democratic debate. And, you know, it's interesting, Mark Fowler, the FCC chair under Reagan, you know, tries to eliminate the fairness doctrine. And, you know, there's a bipartisan coalition that comes together to try to ingrain it in law via legislation. But ultimately, Ronald Reagan vetoes that bill. And again, he relies, he says that we just need to allow ideas to compete in the marketplace. And so the fairness doctrine is really significant for the broadcast industry more broadly. And that's where you see its first ramifications. It allows, it kind of frees broadcasters. Cable operators weren't always regulated by that as well. It was very murky as to whether it applied to cable operators or not. But it allows broadcasters, notably radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh, to kind of really double down on partisanship, double down on some of the tactics that proved really effective, like Newt Gingrich stoking outrage, to do that not just for maybe an hour at the end of the congressional day, but for an entire program nonstop. And so it allows this more partisan programming to tap into, again, the marketplace and to show that it can be very lucrative. And I think that's what you see. You know, Fox News emerges in 1996. It's looking at Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch are looking at Rush Limbaugh. They're looking at how he's able to use these tactics to stir outrage and to make a lot of money. And so that's really the business model behind Fox News. And I think that with the Dominion lawsuit, you see some, you know, this level of accountability that the market had not been able to provide. And so I think that, and it also kind of showed that Fox is pandering to what they think that their TV subscribers want, that they will do anything to try to keep their loyalty. And this, again, is a product of relying on the marketplace to deliver for democracy.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to John now in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to share that one time I asked my 90-year-old father-in-law what was the biggest change that he ever saw in his lifetime. And he said the 24-hour news cycle and all the stress that it caused and all the potential for propaganda that it caused. And I remember being a little boy, probably in second, third grade, probably 1972. And I heard about the communists in Russia and how the little kids were propagandized by state media. And I remember feeling sorry for them. I mean, I truly felt sorry for these kids being propagandized in communist Russia. And today, the free cable media, but study after study shows that over 80% is tilted one way.
John, thanks a lot for the call. John's father-in-law says the 24-hour news cycle, the biggest change he saw in his lifetime. Catherine, you'd make the case it is a pretty big deal.
It really is significant because it's dramatically expanding the information that people have about the world around them. It's really decentralizing the news. And there are some benefits to this. Again, it brings new voices, new perspectives. The network broadcast television newsrooms run, you know, with Walter Cronkite at the center stage, those were incredibly exclusionary. They were elitist. They really did kind of adhere to a perspective of white heterosexual men. And so opening up the news really creates all of these possibilities. But again, it's always driven by the search for profits. Even Ted Turner, that great clip you played at the beginning, where CNN is launching to promise to deliver understanding and peace, Ted Turner wanted to make money. And so he's really finding different ways to do news on the cheap. So he wants to make news the star, is what he says. He doesn't want to pay someone like Walter Cronkite. Well, when there's breaking news, this provides people with access to information. But then what happens when there's not breaking news or there's not a crisis? Then you have the reliance on a lot of this commentary and more opinion-based shows. And that's where, again, to the earlier point, you get the conflating of news and entertainment that can it can really undermine public knowledge.
Talking to Catherine Kramer Brownell about her new book, 24/7 Politics, Cable Television, and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. I want to get to the fragmenting, Catherine, before we run out of time. You talk about in the book the incentive structure for politicians. Instead of trying to give a more general message to reach as much of the public as they can, you see cable changing the incentive to reaching a particular audience with particular messages. How does that change things?
Yeah, so the book really charts that you have this shift from broadcasting, right? Trying to appeal to broad audiences through radio and television. And so someone like Franklin Roosevelt is using the fireside chats to try to build popular support for his programs. And he's, you know, again, circumventing critics to speak directly to audiences. But again, the whole idea is to make his programs more likable. Cable is a little bit different because it relies on more narrow segments and mobilizing very vocal, narrow, smaller segments of the population. It's all about cultivating loyalty, not necessarily likability. Loyalty to individual brands, loyalty to individual lifestyles, infusing that with politics. And so it makes it more about kind of connecting to what is seen as the quote unquote right demographics, those people that'll be more passionate, that'll be more engaged about politics, and kind of eschewing that responsibility of reaching everybody and that desire to build consensus around ideas, candidates, and policies.
And I think a lot of people would point at social media and the internet for doing the things you just said. You move that dial back a lot further with cable TV. That set us up, it seems, for the fragmented politics we have today.
Exactly. I think that the way in which social media has unfolded, this search for, you know, anything that will generate ratings and clicks, and what does that? You can see the business model time and time again that shows that getting people angry is what can really motivate that business. It's not necessarily encouraging, an informed conversation or, you know, even a respectful conversation in any capacity. It's really tapping into that kind of cultivating different brands, different identities. And, you know, one of the things that cable introduces is it shows how profitable echo chambers can be. And I think that really is at the root of some of our polarization today in both media and politics.
Catherine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for the conversation.
That was Catherine Kramer Brownell, Associate Professor of History at Purdue University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called 24/7 Politics, Cable Television and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a convention of stay-at-home dads is meeting in Milwaukee later this week. We'll check out that get-together and look at the roles of dads in the household, and we're hoping you'll share your experiences. You can get us started right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. Have you been a stay-at-home dad at some point in your life? What led to the decision? How did it go? What did you think of it? Do you think more dads should do that or have the opportunity to do that? Let us know right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. Also tomorrow, when same-sex couples get married, they face some obstacles, and it's not just about politics. A Wisconsin researcher shares a new study that finds that the wedding industry hasn't caught up with the needs of same-sex couples here in the United States. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, conservative think tanks are developing plans for a potential new Republican administration that would drastically expand the powers of the president when it comes to appointments, hiring, and especially firing. Find out what that could mean for the executive branch and for limits on presidential power. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.